Welcome. I'm Ethan Elkind, filling in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls One Planet series. Later in today's program, we're going to discuss the Trump administration's effort to dismantle the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. But first, we're going to talk about how the rising cost of home insurance in California and other regions in the country, driven by climate change, is pushing up the cost of owning a home and eroding the economic security of tens of millions of people. A new study by the First Street Foundation, a research firm that studies climate threats to housing, predicts that nearly $1.5 trillion in asset losses over the next 30 years may happen. And if insurance rates continue to spike, the cost of owning a home will increase while property values will drop. In his article in ProPublica, today's guest, Abram Lustgarten, writes that climate change and rising insurance costs are shifting how Americans view and value home ownership, essentially upending the American dream. Abram Lustgarten is an investigative reporter writing about climate change at ProPublica and also for the New York Times. And his writing also appears in The Atlantic, The Washington Post, and Scientific American. Abram, welcome to Your Calls One Planet series.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you on the show. Well, I want to start with the recent fires in LA. They've just reminded us of the human and socioeconomic toll of the climate crisis, that these fires in Los Angeles alone could cost an upward of $250 billion. So they really crystallize this issue of how climate change is affecting real estate values, affecting insurance going forward. And just using that as a bit of a microcosm, do you expect to see a demographic change just within these areas in LA as a result of the fires?
Yeah, that's such a hard question to answer. I mean, what we do know is that people are beginning to move in general in response to these climate-driven disasters. And we also know that, you know, California in particular, as well as states along the Gulf Coast, you know, have been on the crux of this home insurance crisis as costs are rising and disasters are driving up those costs and everybody's kind of trying to figure out what to do about it. So the LA fires do a couple of things. They sharply exacerbate that insurance crisis in California, which increases the economic pressures. And at the same time, you know, LA obviously is, you know, a large metro area with extraordinary wealth, and that wealth, you know, conveys some resilience as well. So Los Angeles might not be, you know, the typical kind of reaction that we would see in other parts of the country to a similar crisis. And it makes it really hard to predict what will happen to LA. Surely people will leave who don't want to live amidst the ongoing and worsening heat and fire risk for that area. But, you know, the experts that I speak with, you know, also project, you know, a rebuilding and, you know, and a certain resiliency that goes with the economic might that Los Angeles has.
Well, it seems like so much of what's likely to happen in places like LA dealing with these climate fueled disasters is based on economics. And we know that these fires hit very different parts of LA. Pacific Palisades, which is the center of one of those fires, is among the wealthiest enclaves in the nation with an average household income of $375,000, three times the city average. Whereas on the other hand, Altadena, which also experienced the brutal Eaton fire, has an average household of income of $130,000 a year. And so we're seeing different demographics as a result. And do you think the differences in the wealth and potentially the density and government support for rebuilding in these neighborhoods may affect not only the demographics, but just how and when these cities can rebuild?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we'll see these two neighborhoods and wealthy versus less wealthy neighborhoods in general go in two sharply different directions, both in terms of how they handle risk and how they rebuild. And for the reasons you just said, Pacific Palisades is much more likely to have the both the coverage and the wealth to rebuild and probably re-achieve its past glory. Altadena might wind up in an entirely different situation where, you know, at least middle class, portions of that community are more likely to be rebuilt, with higher end housing that will change, you know, the whole price equation of living in that community and might put living in that community out of reach for some of the people there, or might just change the character of that neighborhood and also who owns that property. So the experts that I'm talking to say that it's more likely that you'd see at least a rising cost of living, sharply rising cost of living in Altadena. And you also might just see, you know, a consolidation of ownership that turns, you know, average residents into renters as opposed to home ownership, as opposed to homeowners, and, you know, and brings investors or private equity groups and so on into the ownership category.
Well, in this region, in LA and throughout places like California, many of our thriving urban centers in the United States are already facing a severe housing shortage, high housing costs. And a UCLA study warned that as a community rebuilds in these areas, those already struggling to break into home ownership may find themselves locked out altogether. So can you talk about how the fires are exacerbating our existing housing shortage and pricing people out at really at this point at almost all range of incomes under only, you know, just the highest income earners in these regions?
Yeah. And to answer that, let me take a step back to the 40,000 foot view here, which is that, you know, we have known for a while that climate change is going to be extraordinarily expensive. It's going to cost governments and individual people an immense amount of money. And so the question in the conversation has been, you know, what does that look like and where will it hit first and how will we feel it? And so what we see happening in response to the wildfires in Los Angeles and in response to the insurance crisis is one of the most substantial ways that we're seeing that economic impact individually first. It is a climate-driven sharp increase in the cost of living for, you know, people who own homes. It is increasing the cost of owning that property, and it is changing the equation of, you know, what makes it affordable to own a property. And the first street research that I wrote about essentially is finding that the trajectory of increasing insurance costs is so steep that it is outpacing the appreciation rate for a lot of properties. We've enjoyed a couple of decades, you know, in the United States where home values, if you already own a home, have increased astronomically. And that's been a great equity cushion, a great wealth cushion, and a great way of saving for a great number of Americans. And so the First Street research suggests that rising insurance prices driven by climate change is changing that. And so that means a couple of different things. It means if you already own a home, it's going to become a whole lot more expensive to continue to own that home. And you might have a cushion if you've appreciated that value over the last couple of decades, if you've been in it for a long time. And that cushion might sustain losses, or if you have been in the market for a shorter period of time, you might expect a depreciation in that value and losses in the future, which just changes the way that Americans save. Most, I think 67% of American homeowners have the majority of their savings in their home equity. And so this raises questions about whether that's viable in the future. Now, if you're a new homeowner, if you're a younger person entering the market, or you're looking to kind of establish that toehold, you know, that classic way of building American wealth, what these trends suggest is that we have one more reason why the cost of homes is going to continue to, you know, to increase, and not just the sale price of homes, because we're talking about maybe a decrease in value, but the cost of owning a home, the total component, you know, having insurance, maintaining that home against risk, paying the cost of rebuilding it if there's disasters or partial disasters, and then of course buying it and getting a mortgage. So that total cost is going to continue to increase dramatically, and that's going to lock a lot of people out. It's going to make it difficult to enter into the market as a first-time home buyer, and it's going to, you know, change the equation, even if you can get in, whether it's a smart thing to do or not. And it's going to intersect and compound with this existing housing crisis and shortage of housing that we already have in only negative ways. There is not really a positive outcome from that interaction.
When we're talking about the impact of climate change on U.S. home prices, on the value of home ownership, just discussing this recent L.A. wildfires as an example of how climate change is undermining housing, not only destroying it through things like fire events, but also raising the cost of owning a home through insurance. We're joined by Abram Lustgarten, investigative reporter writing about climate change at ProPublica and also for the New York Times. And Abram, I'm really glad you zoomed out and talked about the sort of national dynamics and the study from First Street, the research firm that studies climate threats to housing and really provides some of the best climate adaptation data available, both freely and commercially. Now, they estimated nearly $1.5 trillion in asset losses in U.S. real estate over the next 30 years. Can you talk about how they came up with this figure? I mean, it's truly staggering to try to contemplate.
Yeah, so to arrive at that figure, they use a very, purely financial measurement that's a, a common way of evaluating, business investments on Wall Street, but might not capture all the, varied reasons why Americans own homes. So, so it's important to kind of understand that context. But they essentially look at, the costs versus the benefits from, a pure spreadsheet standpoint, and they find that as insurance costs rise and other, costs of owning a home, the risk of disasters increase, that the long-term profit potential or the appreciation potential drops. And so, if you're looking at investing in a business and you think of your home as a business proposition, that means it's a losing proposition and it's not worth doing. And that's what their models reflect. And they find that, they project it that in 85% of census tracts across the country, so the vast majority of the country, there will be some kind of net decrease in, in home values over the next 30 years. And that is a mixture of places that might see the slightest decrease and really remain fairly stable, and places that will see a sharp decrease in value, the places most vulnerable, the coasts of the Gulf Coast and parts of Florida, for example. Now, what those models can't capture is, the various other factors that contribute to homeownership, like stability and security and community and living in a beautiful place or quality schools or, raising a family. So there's all these, intangible aspects that might not fit into that cost balance equation. And there's lots of reasons why a home might still be a good investment for people by those other measures, but that's not exactly what First Street measured.
Well, the study also suggests that more than 55 million Americans may end up relocating due to climate risks in the coming decades, which would also contribute to shifting real estate values. Can you talk about what that kind of dynamic, that trend of essentially climate refugees just within the United States would look like and what that might do to real estate values?
Yeah, absolutely. So, again, to zoom back out, this is climate-driven migration is an area I've been reporting on over the last couple of years, and wrote a book on the move about climate migration in the United States, analyzing, what the push and pull factors are, including the kind of research that First Street is doing, but a lot of other research as well. And, so my own reporting suggests that we will see a mass migration of people in this country of somewhere between 10 and 160 million people. And it's really hard to pinpoint. Obviously, that's a phenomenally large, almost meaningless range. But what it does mean is that how whatever number of people are displaced by their changing environment, it will be, by several factors, the largest human migration in US history. And so, the First Street research connects that economic decline with migration as another of the kind of push factors. In my book, I analyze a lot of ways in which rising economic costs will put pressure on people to move, and that migration in response to climate change will be in response to a change in people's, economic welfare and in people's prosperity. And so that means a lot of things. It means, the rising cost of utilities if you need to cool a home that didn't need to used to be cooled in South Texas, or the rising cost of insurance, or the cost of rebuilding or re-landscaping, all of those things, coupled with the changing economic opportunity. If you see businesses or industries relocating to more sustainable parts of the country, that means that there's, less opportunity to earn good wages in vulnerable parts of the country, in Florida or the Gulf Coast or the Southwest, and there might in the future be more opportunity in destination places. And so the First Street research sort of jumps right in the middle of those projections and, and throws out this number of 55 million Americans moving. And I would say, take that number with a grain of salt, because it's hard to forecast, how many people will move. And there's a lot of complex human decisions that are involved in that make it really difficult to model. But the message is still worthy, and that's that we're going to see a very large number of people respond to climate pressures by changing where they live. And, that injects a certain amount of, chaos and change economically, into our demography. It means that, certain communities will grow, and their challenges will be, how do you receive that growth and how do you plan for it? them and you know, create opportunity both from it, but for the people who move there. And if you're in one of those shrinking communities, how do you manage that, you know, that degrowth, which I mean, not in the liberal sense of, you know, of degrowth, but how do you literally proportionally keep your tax base, you know, proportional to the number of people that are there to support the community and make sure you can invest in infrastructure and keep your schools open and things like that with a smaller population.
Well, let's bring in listeners, because I'm imagining listeners, you know, particularly in places like the Bay Area and Southern California, are feeling this firsthand. And I'd love to hear from you if you're listening to this conversation, if your home insurance rates have gone up, if this is causing you to consider moving, if you're worried about the value of your home because of climate change and because of rising costs like insurance that are reflecting these climate-fueled disasters. We'd love to hear from you. The number to call to join this conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us at yourcall@kalw.org if you want to join. Otherwise, I want to let listeners know I'm Ethan Elkind filling in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls One Planet series. We're joined by Abram Lustgarten, an investigative reporter writing about climate change for ProPublica and the New York Times, among other outlets. And he's also the author of several books, including his latest On the Move, The Overheating Earth and the Uprooting of America. And the number again to join us is 866-798-TALK or 866-798-8255. Well, Abram, what about the impacts on intergenerational transfer of wealth? Because for so long, that is how people have been able to pass down wealth to their children. It's not only just about their savings, but the ability to build up that savings and then pass it on. So what are the implications for that dynamic that many people, many families have come to rely on over the years?
Yeah, gosh. I mean, this, you know, isn't exactly my, you know, my bailiwick, but just to say that, you know, the cost will increase for those inherited values, which doesn't make them not valuable or not worth holding on to, but it changes the equation, right? If you, if you inherit property that is vulnerable to climate impacts, then you also inherit that responsibility and that risk. And as costs rise, you know, the value of wealth passed on diminishes. So the exact same way that we talk about, you know, property not necessarily being the wealth generator for people buying in the future, you know, it's logical to follow that it won't be the wealth generator for people who hold it, and pass it along as well. Simply put, the costs of owning property are going to increase, changing the benefit equation.
Mm-hmm. We have an email question in. Eduardo in Berkeley writes, are there any places that may benefit from climate change? So I guess the question is going to, are there places in this country where climate change may make the weather better or somehow drive up values because people want to go to these spots as a potential refuge?
Yeah, I mean, not benefit in the sense that, you know, life overall is going to get better. I mean, climate change is going to negatively impact, you know, every inch of the planet. You can zero in on things like, would you like Buffalo, New York to be, you know, a less wintry place and have nicer summers? Maybe. And that will happen. But climate change is also bringing, you know, greater discontinuity and chaos and unpredictability to all sorts of places and increasing risk. So I talk about it more, you know, in the context of, you know, which places might be less impacted. And there are, relatively speaking, you know, comparatively speaking, safer places. And, you know, every place has its risk, but we look at the Great Lakes region and the Northeast and, you know, the further north in the United States as being places that will, you know, see less extreme impacts and changes, that are less subject to wildfires and obviously don't, you know, have a hurricane risk, and have ample supply of fresh water. And those are things that will make, you know, regions more resilient in the future. And then you bring into the equation, you know, the prospect of climate-driven migration and also migration in agricultural areas and where, you know, where it's practical to grow food, and where land is becoming, you know, more arable and more productive, and you see opportunities for growth in some of those same, you know, relatively safer regions. And you know, the caveat is, if you're a city in Michigan that's expecting to see, you know, large amounts of population growth. You can seize that growth if you're prepared for it and you can handle it. And if you're unprepared for it, that growth can lead to chaos. So there's a bit of a, you know, a crossroads and an opportunity, but a decision, a policy decision for those, you know, states and localities to consider. But the opportunity is to generalize, you know, is northward, and the greater impacts will fall southward.
And Abram, given this dynamic of really just pretty gloomy outlook for real estate and for the climate as a whole, for that matter, what advice would you give to those who are considering purchasing a home at this point?
Well, it really depends on where you're considering purchasing a home. And I'm, you know, I'm a homeowner myself. Building materials and, you know, landscaping and home hardening against wildfire in particular can be extraordinarily effective. So that's, you know, that's one first step. I guess my advice would be don't stretch so thin that it's barely affordable, because the rising costs will shift that barely affordable into unaffordable pretty quickly. So if you have the cushion or the flexibility to absorb some of those rising costs, then this looks like a better future for you. A lot of the experts and economists that I've talked to in the last couple of weeks talk about the wisdom of renting. And that's a little bit of a psychological shift from, you know, what many Americans have aspired to and, you know, and how we define, you know, that idea of the, you know, the quote unquote, the American dream. But from a pure financial perspective, being a renter is a way to maintain flexibility in the future that lets you put your savings and your wealth in different kinds of places. Maybe that means the stock market or, you know, or something other than actual property. And so when something does happen to your property or to the place that you live in, a different owner absorbs the costs of that and you're somewhat protected.
And what should the policy response here be? We know we should be taking greater action to try to reduce the fossil fuel emissions that are making this crisis worse, but we know the Trump administration is actively working to dismantle those efforts. Are there other policy efforts that we could put in place to try to potentially protect the economy from what seems like is going to be a major shock to have all this real estate value lost over the coming decades and then beyond that? What do you think we should be thinking about just in terms of policy to address that particular aspect of climate change?
Yeah, I mean, the experts and economists that I talk to have a very, very long list of fairly obvious, you know, policy solutions. So there's clear directions to go in and according to them and, you know, and choices to be made. And they range from, well, first of all, you know, limiting carbon emissions will slow the rate of warming and the impacts that we're seeing. So that makes a very concrete difference, cutting emissions this year as opposed to next year. All of that pushes off the severity of the kind of impacts that we're seeing very measurably. So that's important to do, but you also have to adapt to the changes that are already underway. And there are, you know, there's a long list of ways to do that. Choosing randomly from the list of prescriptions I get, using insurance, state-sponsored insurance in places like California or Florida or Texas, to protect people who need that economic protection, but not using it to justify the expansion of development into vulnerable places. Right? So not providing insurance to a new housing developer that wants to develop wildland, you know, in the foothills of the Sierra Nevada mountains in California. That's a policy change that will make a big difference in decreasing the number of people and, you know, the amount of assets that are in harm's way. Mm-hmm. Investing heavily, you know, corralling as much money as possible and spending it to increase, the sustainability of communities, investing in transportation and roads and housing as quickly as possible. These are kind of like old challenges that we have, you know, been behind on and underfunded for a long time, but they also happen to be the things that are most important to making these communities resilient. Mm-hmm. For people, but also economically to, you know, the climate changes that are underway. Unfortunately, I think our trends are in the opposite direction and there always is a shortage of money, but what's really required is to, you know, is to pour as much money into these different issues with as much foresight as possible.
This is Your Calls One Planet series. I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. We're joined by Abram Lustgarten, investigative reporter writing about climate change. And specifically in this case, we're talking about climate change undermining U.S. real estate values and potential losses in that sector. We're almost out of time for this segment, but I want to welcome a caller that we have, James from San Rafael. James, welcome to Your Call.
Oh, thank you. I just wanted to mention, I just sold a house up in the Sierras near Grass Valley. It took me years to find somebody who loved the property enough to be willing to carry fire insurance for the house, which they got through CalFair, which took them forever. The whole deal almost didn't go through. Escrow didn't go through for a long time. They couldn't even reach CalFair. They were calling like 85 times a day to try to get through to those people. Anyway, luckily for me, I found somebody who's, I'm holding the note. So for me to do that, they had to have insurance, of course. They're paying $1,000 a month just for the crappy coverage offered by CalFair. That's really impacts real estate sales in an area like Grass Valley up there. Anyway, I just wanted to mention it really does impact real estate sales and trying to get the deal closed.
Yeah, I appreciate you sharing that story, James. I can only imagine this is essentially tip of the iceberg. Maybe it's a bad pun in terms of what's happening. Abram, any comments on James' story here?
But only that is, you know, the prime example of how this works. So to clarify, you know, CalFair, the FAIR plan is California's state-sponsored plan to subsidize or ensure that anybody can get insurance. And so the state organizes that and absorbs a small amount of the cost and manages that program. And 30 states across the country have similar programs to do that. And so, you know, a place like Grass Valley is extraordinarily vulnerable to, you know, climate-driven wildfires in the future. And, you know, anybody who lives there should be, you know, should be concerned about that development. And so that changes the whole dynamic about whether it's financially attractive to own property there. And, James's example is, it gets right to the heart of the matter, which is, you know, you have a state program, which is to help people who are already invested and need to protect their assets. And it probably shouldn't be used to allow more building in that area, but you can't just move everybody out. And so it's quite difficult. And so we're in this gray area right now where, you know, people who can get the insurance or who can afford to live without it, you know, might move in, and people who don't want to, you know, face that risk, might slowly be moving out. Mm-hmm.
And we have another question, email question in from Robin, who wrote, I think you wrote in On the Move, your book, Abram, that the San Francisco Bay would rise in the South Bay to as far as El Camino. I live in Palo Alto in the South Bay. So should Robin be worried?
Yeah, thanks for reading the book. That's wonderful. So the projections, I think the study that I used, you know, in writing about that suggests that about 750,000 people in the Bay Area will be displaced by, you know, by rising seas. And I'm not expert in exactly which communities, but a lot of the, you know, the hardest hit regions are, you know, in the southeastern part of the Bay, and then, you know, the North Bay around San Rafael and up to Petaluma. So those are the real hot spots of vulnerability. If you the projections I see are between, you know, 7 to 9 feet of sea level rise by the end of the century. And, that sounds like a long way off, but it's coming quickly. And that means several feet by mid-century. And the more development in those places, there's also subsidence issues. So if you live, you know, within that range of sea level, yes, you should be worried. And you should be worried, you know, for what happens to the infrastructure in your community, your highway access and your local taxes as your community deals with things like those highways and other infrastructure as well.
Yeah, so many local impacts that we have to worry about. We're basically out of time, Abram, but I just want to ask you one last question, which is, do you think that the politics of climate change may change in a potentially a positive direction in terms of taking climate action as more and more people experience these climate disasters? Or do you think it could maybe go the other way, that people become more cynical and more conspiratorial or less likely to support climate action?
In my reporting, I see both things happening at the same time, and it doesn't necessarily fall along, you know, liberal conservative lines, but there are people, coming to terms with rapid environmental change in this country who, instead of trying, you know, seeking to slow or stop that change are just looking to protect themselves in the face of it. And so, you know, that's a political division. Other than that, I think it's way beyond me to offer even the slightest prediction of where our climate policy goes from here.
Well, Abram Lustgarten, author of several books, including On the Move, The Overheating Earth, and The Uprooting of America, and investigative reporter writing about climate change at ProPublica, thank you so much for joining us on Your Calls One Planet series.
Thank you for having me.
And coming up after this short break, we're going to talk about Trump efforts to dismantle the United States Environmental Protection Agency. So stay with us here on Your Calls One Planet series. We'll be back just after this short break.